Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. State officials announced over the weekend they will lend money to Pontiac schools to avert a Payless payday. But there's no resolution in Buena Vista Township near Saginaw, where that school system abruptly shut down after running out of money. On today's show, a temperature check on school funding across Michigan. Just how many districts are close to the financial edge? But first, to Detroit, where money is also on the front burner. That's where a new report has been released on the city's disastrous finances. Detroit's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, released his report taking an in-depth look at the city's books. The state's emergency manager law requires him to issue this report 45 days after his appointment. So this is clear. Detroit is broke, and its finances are in worse shape than anyone previously understood. The city has almost $9.5 billion in bonds and other debt, almost $6 billion in unfunded retiree health care, and will end its budget year with a $162 million cash flow shortfall. Emergency manager Kevin Orr joins us now. Kevin, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much, Cindy. Good to talk to you.
Well, no one is surprised that Detroit is in a financial crisis, but I'm wondering, was it as bad as you thought it would be before you stepped into the Coleman A. Young building, sat down in that office? Was it as bad as you thought it would be?
It's somewhat worse than I thought it would be. I mean, I had not understood. You know, I'd done some research before I came in to the position, was appointed by Governor Snyder, but I had not understood the longstanding historical context of the problem and the level of, if you would, interfund borrowing. In the city. That's pretty significant.
Is that what my mother used to call borrowing from Peter to pay Paul?
Borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. I mean, that's exactly right. City's been doing it for a long time.
So put this into context for the average listener, if you can,
sure.
Who are not bankruptcy lawyers. What do these numbers really look like? What do they really mean?
Well, what I've been trying to tell people is imagine this. The city takes in about $1 billion, down from $1.25 billion a couple of years ago, every year. The city owes all in somewhere neighborhood of $15.6, maybe $16 billion, which is greater than by another $2 billion than the $14 billion we have previously been discussing. So it's a significant amount of money. Two things I would say to give them some gain. This year, so far this year, the total number of initial public offerings, that is companies in America that wanted to go public on the stock markets, about $16.1 billion, all in for the year. In other words, our level of debt is akin to the amount of money that new companies in America needed this year so far to start. Or put another way, if you stop doing everything the city does every year, police, fire, EMT, fireworks, water, street cleaning, garbage pickup, whatever, everything the city does, we could not pay our bill in 15 years, half a generation.
Why is there such a disparity, Kevin, between what we'd been hearing from city leaders and then what you found once you came in and you could open up the books and look in every corner? Was it incompetence? Were people hiding things?
No, I've stayed away from, in both my report and trying to communicate, I've stayed from sort of apportioning blame. I think this mayor and city council, for instance, have tried to do the best they can with the tools they had in their toolbox. I think what really happened years and years ago, I mean, this has been coming our way in one fashion or another from demographics 40 years ago to high-level administration and the prior high-level of mismanagement in the prior administration, not Mayor Bings, but before that, and neglect. And now it's just come to a head. So it's been working its way here for a number of years. The combination of the financial crisis, the borrowing and debt, the unfunded obligations we have, actuarial tables, retirees, the fact that we have two retirees for every employee we have, and that's not sustainable. All those things coming together now and trying to give everybody just a snapshot of what they are make it look so grave, so dire.
Now, critics will say, well, he's painting a bleaker, darker picture than really exists because whatever steps he takes, he's got to look like he's making a bigger difference. Or they may say it fits the governor's declaration that Detroit had to be taken over by an emergency manager. And to that you say?
To that I say, fine. This is totally open book. Come in. These numbers are entirely sustainable. They have been worked over every which way from Sunday. You know, unless those critics have a leprechaun and a pot of gold under their arm, I say to them, come in with a plan. If you don't think this is the truth, then you come in with something different. But it is the truth, And while we may disagree about what we should do about it or how we got here, these are the facts on the ground today that are non-negotiable and non-debatable. This is just the way it is.
Kevin, what is the takeaway for the people who are living in those neighborhoods in the city of Detroit whose lives are affected each and every day by this budget crisis?
Well, I hope the first takeaway is that, you know, the Chinese proverb, the trip of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. I hope that's their takeaway, that finally we've gotten to a point where we have a common ground. Even those that are detractors don't have a reasonable, rational alternative. I mean, a logical, rational person is going to look at this situation and say, it's not sustainable. We can't keep doing this. So I hope those people never say, hey, we're at least now talking off the same page, and we have a common language that we can work from, and we're going to get help. We're going to get help. And Cindy, think of it this way. You know, we've been working our way here for 40 years. I've been here for 45 days, and I've given the first snapshot. Let's just say we've been working our way here for the past 12 years. Okay, in 45 days, I've given what I think is a true snapshot. And in the next 16 and a half months, I've got to come up with a solution. That's a precious small amount of time to wait for that solution, given how long it took us to get here.
What do you say to, let's say, first of all, city retirees? Talk to the retirees who are hearing this discussion and are understandably nervous about what the future may hold.
First and foremost, I hope they understand that, you know, I and my team understand their situation. My mother's a retired school teacher, school superintendent, for instance. She had to have brain surgery years ago. Thank God she had a health care plan that could afford it. There's a difference between life and death, literally. So I get it. I get that aspect of it. I hope they also understand, though, that they're in a city where the numbers are what the numbers are. And while we're going to try to come up with humane solutions in a way that allows them the opportunity and the right to continue, for instance, to getting some portion of their retirement and their health care benefits, we have to look at this in a very sober and rational way, because there's no alternative. We can't keep doing what we're doing.
And I take it that message essentially for bondholders as well?
Absolutely. For the creditors, the creditors are very astute, sophisticated financial professionals. They've already hired counsel. We know who their counsel are. Heck, I've been co-counsel on the other side of some of their attorneys.
Yeah.
They're looking at the same numbers I'm looking at. They know this isn't sustainable.
After you've looked at these numbers, and now that you've presented this snapshot of the finances, how much more likely would you say that a bankruptcy filing for the city would be?
You know, everybody's asking me that.
Yeah.
I keep saying this again and again, Cindy. I want to avoid a bankruptcy filing, because I think if we can negotiate in good faith, we can get to where we're going to be. Now, that's not going to be easy, because the amount of movement that we're going to need from all stakeholders is significant, and it's going to be contrary to what people are used to. But if we don't do it, I have to keep all alternatives on the table. I don't have a choice.
I'm sure you understand there's a lot of anxiety, especially if you're a city retiree.
Sure.
And there's great impatience to hear more from you than the snapshot of how bad things are. And they're wondering, what do you feel you're going to need to do to fix things? Can you give us any sense of what your goals are going to be and what your proposed fixes may look like?
Well, I can't give you the granular details. Let's just say at 35,000 feet, you know, if we're looking at it from that perspective.
Right.
Now, I put them into three buckets. I mean, number one, we've got to rationalize city government the way we work, continuing in the way we budget, continue to borrow from interfunds and pushing off to tomorrow, kicking a can down the road, is it going to work? And we've got to become more efficient for this city to have a sincere chance in the 21st century to compete with other American cities. Number two, we've got to look at how we deal with our long-term liabilities. They're just out there as a 600-pound gorilla in the room. There's nothing we can do to avoid it. We've got to address that in some way or the other. I hope to do that in a way that preserves people's retirement and their health care, but it's got to be dealt with in some fashion. And number three, what I would say is, you know, going forward in terms of city government, we've got to think in ways of how operationally the city can work better, so that the citizens, there's a great deal of energy in the city right now, Cindy, in the foundation community, in the business community, as you may have heard, folks like Dan Gilbert, the Illiges, others in this community. Roger Pinsky's race is getting ready to stop. He's just invested $2 million in new Tarmac, so it's an international event. There's a great deal of energy in the city right now to move it forward from the developmental stage. We've got to be the kind of city that invites that kind of innovation, invites that kind of opportunity, invites that kind of growth, because once we get past this era, the thing we really have to look down the road at is what Governor Snyder has said again and again, is growing the city. And this is the first step in that effort.
What do we look for next? What is in your mind as far as a timetable when we might start hearing your plans be made public?
Well, I'm going to start negotiations. I think the first thing to do is to have some fairly closely held negotiations with stakeholders, and I'm preparing to engage in that. In 30 days, I have a statutory obligation to have a public meeting about this report, but I'm going to start, for instance, talking to you and other members in the press to speak to people, residents, other stakeholders about where we're heading, to try to be very open, very engaging, and to make sure that people understand whatever the facts are, good, bad, and the ugly, I'm going to put them out there so we can have an honest, rational discussion. And that's going to get us to where we need to be, because while you may disagree with whether or not the emergency manager's here or have issues with what the options are, you can't disagree with the numbers. You know, there's an old saying, figures don't lie, but liars figure. Well, I'm not going to figure. I'm going to tell you the truth.
Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. Kevin, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside. I know we'll be talking again.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio, and I'm Cynthia Canty. State officials announced late last week they will lend money to Pontiac schools and thus avert a Payless payday. But there's still no resolution in sight for Buena Vista Township, where the school system there abruptly shut down after running out of money a month before the end of the school year. As Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett reports, teachers, parents, and students there are trying to figure out what to do next.
There are no satisfying answers coming from the usual voices of authority on this one.
I hope the school district can work something out there.
That's what Governor Snyder had to say about plans to educate Buena Vista's 400 students. So, okay, let's ask the superintendent, as a reporter did at last week's school board meeting. When might students be allowed to return to school?
I don't have that authority.
Deborah Hunter Harville said the person who could answer that question was the school board president, Randy Jackson.
It's going to take some money to do that.
Money the district doesn't have after the state put a hold on aid payments to recoup close to $500,000 it gave the school system to run a program that it, in fact, did not run.
I just don't have the authority to fix it.
That's state school superintendent Mike Flanagan, who told WJR the district would have run out of money even earlier had the state not bailed it out with loans. But that line of credit has run out. There is one group of people who offered a solution to this mess. Buena Vista teachers offered to work for no pay so they could see their students through the end of the year. But the school district declined that offer. So Marcy Carwatt and the district's 26 other teachers are gathering their belongings and wondering what's next.
This is my classroom. I'm going to go over by my desk and pack.
Carwatt teaches kindergarten. She's been with Buena Vista Schools for 17 years. Things ended so abruptly, there's still classwork from students that hasn't been picked up. She's rented a storage unit to hold all the posters, crayons, marbles, and other gear she's bought over the years until she figures out what her future holds. But it's not her future she's most worried about. She says she hates the way things ended for her kids, 5- and 6-year-olds who went home on a Friday just like any other and who had no idea that that was it. No end-of-the-year parties. No saying goodbye.
I think the kids at high school knew more. Our kids didn't know. I'm sorry. This is very sad. Because just having a chance to say goodbye.
I never heard anything like this ever happen to a school. Never heard of it happening.
Thomas Darby has 2 kids in Buena Vista schools. He's heard about the district's plan to balance the books and reopen in the fall. That plan calls for closing the elementary and middle schools. But Darby says he doesn't want his 8-year-old in the same building with high schoolers.
Next year, I have to transfer him somewhere.
Some families aren't waiting.
My name is Antoine Cooper. I'm in 6th grade.
Cooper sits at a table with a stack of photocopied worksheets from his new Saginaw District Middle School, where he'll finish out the year.
It's crazy. Then I gotta go to another school, and it's only like 30 some more days of school left.
If enough parents decide to do what Cooper's parents did, that will speed the death spiral that's already gripped Buena Vista. And hanging on to its existing students, let alone attracting new ones, gets more difficult for Buena Vista every day its doors remain shut. The Buena Vista School Board has requested a state review that could wind up with the district being run by an emergency manager, but that process takes months, and that doesn't help the 400 displaced students who are missing classes again today. I'm Sarah Hewlett, Michigan Radio News.
And you are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and I'm joined now by Tom Watkins. He is the state's former state superintendent of Michigan schools. Tom, welcome.
It's always good to be with you. Thank you, Cynthia.
And we also have with us Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He joins us as well. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So we have the two of you here this afternoon. As we try to pick apart just what is happening in school districts in Michigan and just where education funding is in our state. So when we hear a story about a school district ending a month earlier, essentially saying, sorry, we don't have the money to keep the doors open, it really does raise a red flag. And Tom, I want to start with you. Help us first to understand just how did the Buena Vista School District get to where it is today?
Well, there's two issues, I think, going on. One is that it appears that there was an inappropriate use of resources that they were serving some kids at a juvenile detention facility. They stopped doing that and continued to collect the money. But the bigger issue is the issue of school finance. And I pointed this out in a report called Structural Issues Facing Michigan's Schools in the 21st Century. Back in 2004, where I said that the educational system, the funding system in our state, is unsustainable. And sadly, we're seeing that across the state today, with over 50 school districts that are in financial distress and on the state's watch list today.
Rick, I want to ask you some questioning. Just how is it that the state let things get so bad for the Buena Vista schools without intervening? I mean, there are other districts in Michigan under emergency management. How did Buena Vista slip through?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, as you heard at the beginning of Sarah's piece, that there's sort of this circular finger pointing that the governor says that this is the responsibility of the state superintendent and the Department of Education to deal with this. The state superintendent, Mike Flanagan, says that it's actually the school district that caused this problem and he can't do anything about it. And the school district says, yeah, but we're out of money. That we can't, you know, we can't pay our teachers, we can't pay our support staff, so we can't run classes without those school aid payments. And so sort of what we have is a situation where there's a lot of villains, but no hero who's stepping in with a way to get these kids back in school. I did ask the governor, you know, is this an indication that the early warning systems that the state set up, that it was supposed to be part of the, you know, reforms that were part of the new emergency management law, did they fail here? And he says that Buena Vista is such a unique situation that it really shouldn't be measured by the same standards as we do other situations where local governments or school districts go insolvent. And so that almost seems to say we weren't looking for it, yet we do know that the shutdown, at least, was triggered by the fact that the state cut off the school aid payments.
This school district is, in fact, the canary in the coal mine. There's others that are so financially precarious that a small blip, a little bit of a wave, is going to put them under as well. And that's why that it's absolutely essential that, one, we fulfill our constitutional responsibility to the children of Buena Vista School District and get them the education they need and deserve and is constitutionally protected. But we also look at this issue on a broader perspective and deal with the structural funding problems facing our schools in the state.
Well, let me ask you, Tom, having you know, sat there in the office as the state's superintendent of Michigan schools, so you know what the view is like from Lansing. So let's just look at Buena Vista a little more. Who would you blame here for this, the superintendent or the state?
Well, in fact, I wouldn't blame, because the old saying is when you point a finger at one person, four more are pointing back at you. The point is that we are in this situation, and over 400 children are sitting home, not getting the education they need and deserve, and it's incumbent upon state leaders to step up with the local school district and find a way to get those kids the education that they're constitutionally entitled to. This is something that, quite honestly, is just unacceptable, and the finger-pointing needs to stop, and the work needs to begin to get the kids that. Because if they don't get the education today, it's going to be an adult without much of a future tomorrow.
I'm just even wondering, practically, looking at the timing of the year, have they figured out what will happen to the seniors who are supposed to graduate any day now? What will get to happen to them? Do we know?
Superintendent, Mike Flanagan, the state superintendent, said that he will waive the 180-day school attendance requirement so that the seniors won't at least, you know, lose out because of that, and so that if they otherwise qualify to graduate, then they will be allowed to. My understanding is that the district is planning a graduation ceremony for its seniors.
Meantime, Pontiac appeared to be in a similar situation late last week. We heard, oh boy, here goes Pontiac. And then comes news that the state will release school aid payments to the district of Pontiac so it can meet the payroll. What's going on there with Pontiac?
Pontiac was heading for a payless payday, and that was the state superintendent, Mike Flanagan, warned the district of that in a letter that's part of a financial review that the district is undergoing. It's part of sort of the path to emergency management. And what happened was, after that was revealed, late Friday, the Pontiac School Board met and revamped its deficit elimination plan. The one that it had already submitted was expected to be rejected. It reconfigured it. We don't know how yet. And the state accepted that and said it'll release the school aid payments, so we won't have a second district, a larger district, also shutting down, roughly a month before the end of the school year.
So what we get is Pontiac, yes, they get money from state, but the state is cutting off money to Buena Vista, and both the governor and the state school superintendent say, we can't do anything. Have I got that right? Because it sure doesn't seem to make practical sense.
That's about where it stands right now.
Tom, when you hear this, and I know you started talking about just the fact that this is the canary in the coal mine, and there are some 50 districts on the verge of financial crisis, what do you think these districts have in common? Is there one certain thing at fault, the way the schools have funded or money was used, or are there kind of a convergence of factors that's leading to the financial troubles?
I think that there's a number of issues that are there. One, we've seen resources for the state dwindle. We've seen cuts in public education. But we also have some structural issues. As the Buena Vista School District is a school district of 450 students. We have elementary schools that are larger than that. 40 graduating seniors, only of which 26 qualify to graduate. So we have to ask ourselves, does it make sense to support 550 school districts as small as a 450 student body population? Is that the best way to use limited resources? To put a different way, is if we were to find this state today called Michigan, and we had 1.6 million children with a responsibility to educate, and literally tens of billions of dollars that washed up on our shore every year to provide them the education, would anybody in their right mind create the system that we have today? And I think the answer to that is no. And if we're going to deal with this issue going forward, we're going to have to deal, just like General Motors and the city of Detroit today is dealing with, some of the major structural problems that are facing our schools. And some of that is going to require sharing a service, consolidating school districts, and look at some of the unsustainable cost of operating our schools going forward.
There is another commonality among a lot of these districts, which is they're hemorrhaging students. That Buena Vista in the not-too-distant past was a district of 700-and-something students. Now it's a district of 400 and roughly 420 students, I think. And it's still losing students and the per-pupil state payment that goes with it. And as you lose students, you really can't, if you're a school administrator, you can't cut costs fast enough to meet that hemorrhaging for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of them being that if you've got a class size of 25 and then your class size becomes 20, you still got to pay a teacher and all the attendant costs that go with running a school to deal with the students that you still have.
Rick is absolutely right on that point. And so if you lose, when you figure the state aid, and also a lot of these school districts serve a number of children that are in poverty, so you figure in the federal dollars, in essence, when one student leaves, $10,000 walks out the building. And so, you know, if it's 100 students that left, you've lost $1 million to operate your school. But that issue isn't going to go away, and that's why we need to deal with this on a larger statewide structural basis.
And what would that look like, Tom Watkins? I mean, we've seen the EAA has certainly been a topic of conversation as it kind of begins operations with the 15 schools in Detroit and possibly expanding. We have seen districts under emergency management. But what do you feel as the former state superintendent of schools? What would that fix look like?
Well, the long-term issue is that we're going to have to take a look at downsizing our school districts across the state. And I suggested in this report, people can Google it, the structural issues facing Michigan schools in the 21st century. So we're going to have to look at sharing a service, consolidating school districts, and we're going to have to address the legacy costs of health care and pension. There's only three ways to balance a budget: increase your revenue, decrease your expenditures, or a combination of all three. And we don't seem to put enough resources in order to cover those costs, and we expect the school districts to manage to them. And until and unless we deal with those issues, we're going to continue to see this type of a crisis pop up from time to time.
Rick Pluta, what are you going to watch for next?
Well, I guess a couple of things. There has been a lot of discussion in Lansing of late about school funding and revamping school funding. Typically, it seems to be right now on the cost side and whether or not to induct more competition vis-a-vis charter schools into the system, that the governor recently at the Governor's Education Summit said that he, you know, thought that maybe some things about the proposal A school finance system needed to be revamped, but that he was not going to take the lead on that, that was going to have to come from the local level. I'm wondering if this isn't not unlike the Kalkaska school shutdown in 1993, something that creates a lot of momentum that drives a conversation about school, a school funding overhaul that can't be ignored.
And the point is that while we can always use additional resources in our schools, unless we deal with some of these structural issues, it'll be like pouring more water into a glass with a hole at the bottom and wondering why we can never fill the glass. So until and unless we address a number of these issues. And I think Rick's absolutely right. This may be, and it should be, the state's Kalkaska moment. And that's when we closed down a school, Kalkaska, that brought about Proposal A in 1994. And perhaps we need to move from Proposal A Proposal A plus as the 21st century advances.
Tom Watkins, former state superintendent of the Michigan schools, and Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thanks to both of you very, very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Meantime, some other education news for you. Under a proposal being debated in the GOP-led state house, Michigan teacher performance would play a bigger role in the amount they get paid. Legislation recently debated in the House Education Committee would make teacher job performance the primary factor in determining pay, which could make years on the job and some advanced degrees meaningless. Under current law, job performance has to be only one factor in teacher pay. Supporters argue that moving away from a system that rewards seniority will improve teachers and will benefit students. Opponents worry this policy could cause competition among teachers. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to an idea attracting more and more attention in Michigan and really across the country. It's called placemaking. Placemaking is leading to efforts to create more livable, vibrant, and creative communities. And in short, it could make Michigan cities better, more attractive places to live. We wanted to find out where placemaking is working and how cities across Michigan could benefit. We're joined now by Arnold Weinfeld. He's the Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Michigan Municipal League, and he's joining us from Lansing. Welcome to Stateside, Arnold.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And joining us from Marquette is the city manager, Bill Vida. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Arnold, I'd like to start with you and just explain to us, those of us who are not familiar with this term, what is placemaking?
Sure. I appreciate that opportunity. And actually, I want to start off by saying I don't want to get caught up in the terminology, although we're shooting for a common language these days because communities and community leaders across the state have been engaging in placemaking for a long, long time through their community development efforts, such programs as the Michigan Main Street Program, which has been around about 15 or 20 years, contains a lot of the elements that we're talking about placemaking, about building communities, downtowns and neighborhoods that people want to be in. They want to work there, they want to live there, they want to play there. And creating the kinds of amenities that the market research is showing us people are looking for. At the Municipal League, we started this exploration about 7 years ago or so in the midst of Michigan's decade-long recession, as we sought ways to help our members. We represent cities and villages all across the state of Michigan, as we sought to help our members climb out of the recession. And we started looking around the country at what other cities were doing, you know, the Seattles and Portlands of the world, and also talking to market researchers about what they were seeing and what people are looking for in communities. One of the first statistics that we came upon, very interesting, said that two-thirds of college-age graduates, 25 to 34, look for a place to live first than a job. A
couple of other folks mentioned the same thing, that they look
yep.
to where they want to live, and then they search for the job. And I guess I thought, I think a lot of us did, that it was the other way around. Find the job
other
and follow
around.
It. Yeah.
And a generation ago, generation or two ago, that's the way it was.
Mm.
So one of the other things we found is that those places that were prospering had a high percentage of college-educated graduates. So if we know that college-educated graduates help to raise per capita income and increase prosperity in a community, in a region, and that they're looking for a place to live first, then we better have some pretty darn good places for them to live in. So then you take the next step and you ask, what are they looking for in these places? Why are they looking for places to live first? What is it about those places? And what you find are things like walkability, so walkable downtowns and neighborhoods. There's excellent multimodal transportation, so not just cars available, but public transit, streetcars, the ability to bike from place to place. And these kinds of are the amenities that not just these young professionals are looking for, but what we found, it's also what empty nest baby boomers are looking for. As their kids are now grown up, the empty nest baby boomers no longer are looking to live in that 2,000 and 3,000 square foot house out in the suburbs. They want to be where the action is, where they can go to a restaurant and the play and the show or some downtown club. It's very interesting what the market research is showing. And Michigan has so many assets in each of our communities, differing assets. You know, we're a very large state geographically, we have so many different assets in each of our communities that we can leverage to try and attract these people to our downtowns and our neighborhoods. And so placemaking are the actual actions that one takes, whether it's a local government or a nonprofit or a neighborhood group, to create the kind of place that people want to be in.
And one city that is reaping the rewards of investing resources into placemaking is Marquette, the largest city in the UP. City Manager Bill Vida, Marquette was actually doing this back in the early 1980s, just like Arnold was saying. It wasn't even called placemaking, but Marquette was doing it. What did that look like? What kinds of things were being done?
Yeah. Well, you know, and first let me thank Arnold. He's a good colleague, and he's really set the right context. You know, we appreciate MML's efforts, not so much for, picking the term, but really the concept of placemaking is important because it really facilitates a common dialogue and a common focus. And, you know, if you look 40 years ago at the federal level, they had this term called urban renewal.
They sure did.
And essentially what it resulted in was cities paving over or tearing down large swaths of what they deemed obsolete property. And city centers were being largely abandoned in favor of these huge shopping malls that were kind of replacing these public spaces on the outskirts of cities or in townships or other kind of jurisdictions that really offered maybe less regulations and more opportunity for greenfield type of growth. You know, so we've gone through the cycle of abandoning things. We've gone through the cycle of leveling things. But at the end of the day, when you live in a community, particularly with people who really start walking around and looking at the buildings and trying to figure out what are we going to do to replace maybe businesses that are transitioning or industries that are transitioning, you come up with this idea of placemaking because at the end of the day, you want to live with a quality of life and a lifestyle that supports and attracts vitality and growth to your town. So in Marquette, we enjoy a heritage largely based about 160 years ago in kind of natural resource industries. And over the last 165 years, we've transitioned into one where we're the seat of regional government. We have a university. We have the largest employer in the Upper Peninsula, which is our healthcare network. We have a lot of tourism. We have a lot of retail and manufacturing. And so we've really moved away from those earlier economies towards now more modern 21st-style economies. But you can imagine along the way, natural resources mean you've got lots of big, heavy equipment like trains and trestles and railroad tracks and logging trucks and all kinds of other things that your town is being optimized to support. And when those aren't your predominant industry anymore and you have a lot of that legacy infrastructure laying around your town, you start thinking, well, do I still need that trestle or do I want a park? Hmm. Or do I still need those railroad tracks or would I rather have a bike track? And do we still need, you know, the shopping mall? Or now is the integrated ability to kind of enjoy a park, do a little bit of shopping, maybe stop by a beer garden to enjoy some of Michigan's other agricultural bounty that's very popular these days? Is that the kind of lifestyle people are looking for? And if that's the case, then you start really gearing your economic development strategy to manage that transition.
Yeah, Bill brings up a great point, Cynthia, in that the model of the last 50 years that he was talking about has really become unsustainable. And when I use that word, what I mean is that we only have so many resources mm-hmm. to go around. I mean, you look at the debate these days over transportation funding in this state and the like, and, you know, local officials have been doing a bang-up job of spending taxpayer dollars as efficiently and effectively as possible. And this is a way to spend those taxpayer dollars as efficiently and effectively as possible is to invest in those areas in the downtowns and the neighborhoods where people want to be and where we already have infrastructure already in place to make that go, to make that work.
We're talking about the concept of placemaking and making communities in Michigan really filled with a sense of place and a place that is vibrant and where people want to live. We're speaking with Arnold Weinfeld, who's with the Michigan Municipal League, and the city manager of Marquette, Bill Vida. I'm curious of the thoughts of both of you. What do you say to communities that are already tapped out and drained, both not only in terms of economy and finances, but in terms of the spirit of residents? Can you change gears and get things rolling again in a place like that?
You know, on a statewide perspective, you know, we have been talking to local officials, and not just local officials, but, you know, residents, private sector organizations, nonprofit organizations all across the state and communities across the state. And, you know, even though they may be in a spot that's tougher than some others, the items that we're talking about, the things we're talking about, are all scalable. There's no reason why even the smallest community can't have a sharp downtown, take advantage of whatever parks they may have, and be able to create a kind of attractive place both for their residents and for business. And it can be done. What we tell people to take a look at is, you know, look at your ordinances. Can you do mixed-use commercial residential in your downtown? Have you thought of working with, you know, the largest employer in your community, whether it's a bank or a hospital or whatever it may be? And are you reaching out regionally to other communities in your region, you know, to help you move forward on providing services as well?
and I echo everything Arnold says. What, and from a practical standpoint, I can tell you the public-private element is probably the most critical part for carrying forward. You know, at the bottom of it, the communities all have certain natural advantages. Marquette is blessed to be sitting on the southern shore of Lake Superior, which just provides this beautiful, rich outdoor environment that whether you're able to provide the opportunities through some kind of man-made means or whether people just feel like wandering through nature's glory, they have the opportunity to be distracted in a lot of different ways. And the challenge then becomes for anything that the community would provide, what is that balance and what is that need? And, you know, in the past, what might have happened, and certainly Michigan's experienced this in a lot of different places, typically when communities were looking to provide for parks and recreation or arts and culture or other kind of recreational opportunities, they were typically making their decisions and making their investments at peak demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would build as many soccer fields as they would require to manage it when soccer is very interesting, or they would build to and manage as many baseball fields as the demand was creating. And typically the demands were coming in when the peak number of people were interested in it. But when the tastes of the community change and you don't need as many baseball fields as maybe what you initially invested in, you know, how do you repurpose those and what do you do with those? And so the experience have been that the communities now are focused really less on these capital acquisitions, less on trying to go out and do everything for themselves out of the public money, and looking for new and innovative kind of partnerships with community members, with interested parties for the specific things that they want to see done. And we're blessed in Marquette, and I think that's really the secret sauce, and it's not so much a secret. And there are many, many other communities throughout Michigan that have figured this out, that ultimately placemaking comes down to people who feel very passionately about their community and they want to see good things happen in it. Mm-hmm. And so for most of the events that we have in Marquette, the city's not the one who's putting them on or programming them or really making the investments and the time and energy to see them happen. We provide the basic infrastructure. We take care of all the permitting. We try to make everything as streamlined as possible to enable those good things to happen. And then we step back and get out of the way and just watch the fun.
And get the residents doing it.
Not just the residents. It's, you know, it's the businesses. It's it's the community.
Right.
The jurisdictional lines get very blurred when you start talking about some of the things that people are looking for, you know, the physical jurisdiction to host. But we tend to look at ourselves less as a city in those regards and more as a community of interest.
Yeah, and Bill, Bill's last point there is something that we preach a lot these days, is that local governments should be the host of the party, not the life of the party. Like Bill was just saying, you know, find a way to, you know, bring those people together, get them what they need, and then let them do their stuff. And it works. Like you said, it's the secret sauce. And, you know, Michigan's really blessed to have, you know, a city like Marquette and the work that they've been doing. And it's taken more than just a few years to get it done. And I think that's another point that needs to be made. This is a constant effort that takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. But because of the efforts that have taken place in Marquette, it's the reason why, you know, the Municipal League has chosen Marquette as the place to hold its 2014 annual convention. And we're very excited to come up and showcase a city that's doing things the right way and, you know, garnering national attention as well as state attention for the amenities that they have and for the place that they've become.
And the payoff of that, if that type of mindset goes throughout communities throughout Michigan, is a state that is a more attractive, livable place. And again, doubling right back to what you told us at the beginning, Arnold Weinfeld, about especially these young college graduates and these young professionals that the state wants to hang on to and not lose them to Chicago, when we realize they are looking for that place to live first.
That's key here in Marquette, and I didn't get a chance to opine on that. But, you know, we view ultimately the focus of placemaking to be to capture those young people. I mean, we're also host to universities I mentioned, and ultimately the most scarce resource that there is on the planet are those great brains. And if we're training them and if they want to stay in town and we're not providing them the opportunity to help our local economy, But if we're exporting all those great minds to the benefit of somebody else's economy, we're really defeating kind of the whole purpose of our economic growth plans. And so it's absolutely critical when it gets, it's not just about people who care passionately, but it's people who care passionately and want to stay and contribute. That's the absolute most important part of it all.
Arnold Weinfeld is the Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Michigan Municipal League. He joined us from Lansing. And joining us from Marquette, the city manager of Marquette, Bill Vida. Thank you so much to both of you for your insights and for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Cynthia.